You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
And I'm Brian Wilson alongside Larry O'Connor.
And joining us right now, Ed Klein, author of the new book, Guilty as Sin, uncovering new evidence of corruption and how Hillary Clinton and the Democrats derailed the FBI investigation. Thanks for joining us, Ed.
Hey, it's a great pleasure to be back with you guys. Thanks so much.
Here we are. It's October, and you've got a book out a month before the election, and many people are thinking, well, is there an October surprise? Let's start with that FBI investigation. You say in some of the liner notes for your book that you know what happened on that plane between Bill Clinton and Attorney General Loretta Lynch.
Well, I'm dying to hear that story.
How do you know, and what happened?
Bill Clinton, after Bill Clinton got on that plane with Loretta Lynch at the Phoenix airport in late June, he went back to Little Rock and told one of his friends, who's a source of mine, exactly what happened. He got on that plane. He had no intention of talking about Hillary or the investigation or any of that thing. He said to his friend, I went on that plane because I wanted to make sure that the message got through to everybody in the Justice Department that Loretta was not going to indict Hillary Clinton, Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General. And when he told his friend that Loretta Lynch, as soon as he arrived on that plane, her plane, she realized she had made a huge mistake talking to the husband of a woman who was under FBI investigation, and she started literally trembling, he said. And her husband, Loretta Lynch's husband, started rubbing her back to compose her. And Bill said that he could see beads of perspiration on her upper lip. So she knew instantly she had made a huge mistake, but it was too late because clearly the investigation was totally tainted by that meeting.
And you think that was part of why they came to the final conclusion they did? I'm having a hard time. You say it was not discussed at that
point. Right. What they discussed was exactly what you and I have already heard about. Golf, grandkids, the former Attorney General, Janet Reno. The discussion wasn't the important point. It was the optics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The message was sent. So yeah, just the fact that he visited her sent a signal.
Which was the wrong thing for her to do. And later on, of course, she apologized and said, I'll never do it again. And by then, it was too late. The prosecutors already in the Justice Department, as you will see if you read Guilty as Sin, my new book, they already were telling Jim Comey, the director of the FBI, that they had no intention of indicting Hillary no matter what, because they didn't believe he was getting the smoking gun. He, realizing that the prosecutors, the Justice Department, the White House, the Democrats in Congress, who were calling him Captain Queeg, by the way, behind his back, the paranoid guy in the Kane Mutiny court martial, the Clinton machine, the mainstream media, they were all in favor of Hillary skating.
Huh.
And finally, looking into the mirror, I mean, he didn't literally look into the mirror, but the mirror of his soul, let's say, Jim Comey told his friend, he was going to save the reputation of the FBI and his own reputation by not recommending an indictment.
Wow. Sure didn't turn out that way.
Yeah, boy, that's
I want to ask you about Hillary's medical conditions. Because ever since that moment down at Ground Zero where, I don't care what they say, she passed out and looked pretty wobbly and unstable, we've had some real questions about whether or not we've gotten the straight stuff regarding her health condition. What did you find in your research and in talking to your sources?
In Guilty as Sin, I have a whole chapter, a complete chapter, called Fit to Lead? About Hillary's health. When she fainted back in 2012 when she was Secretary of State and hit her head and had a concussion and a blood clot, if you remember, in her brain, she was rushed to New York Presbyterian Hospital. All that's public knowledge. What isn't public knowledge and what she told her friends and associates later is that she had a complete medical checkup, including a cardiac stress test, and they discovered that she had an arrhythmia of the heart and also a leaky valve. They wanted to replace the valve, the heart valve, with a pig's valve, which is normal, but generally what happens, and she declined on the basis that she told her campaign people that if the public learned that she had a pig's valve in her heart, that she wouldn't be able to run and win the White House. And so she declined. Hmm. In replacing, instead of that operation, they put her on a beta blocker, which brought her low blood pressure already even lower than it was, which causes fainting spells. And she has blood clot tendencies, as we all know, and when she hits herself, those blood clots can go to her heart, her lungs, her brain, and she's always in jeopardy of having a stroke or a heart attack. And so she is under constant medical supervision wherever she goes. She takes rests between her appearances. I'm told that after the 11-hour Trey Gowdy committee hearing, when she left the back door, and nobody saw this, but I was told later, she literally collapsed just the way she did at 9/11, the memorial service, and had to be carried into her car.
Our guest is Ed Klein, author of the new book, Guilty as Sin. It's about Hillary Clinton and a lot of backstage stuff at the Clinton within the Clinton campaign and the Clinton family. He's pretty well sourced, as his history will show. And let's see, we've hit the Loretta Lynch meeting, we've hit the FBI investigation, we hit Hillary's health. Can we get to the sex now?
Can we get to Bill Clinton? Why not?
Stripping interns. Yeah. You've got an amazing story that was excerpted here in the New York Post about a 20-something intern and a foot massage. Do tell, Ed Klein.
Well, you know, it's interesting that the national media has never covered Bill, where he spends somewhere between 30% and 50% of his time, and that is down in Little Rock in his penthouse apartment on the fifth floor of his library, presidential library. He's got this luxurious apartment. He's got a terrace outside.
It's part of the presidential library?
Yeah, fifth floor of the library.
Doesn't that mean
his penthouse apartment?
Don't taxpayer dollars pay for that?
Yes, the National Archives pays for that. So this is taxpayer paid love nest, if you will. Now, this is what I found out. I don't want to go any further than what I found out. I interviewed two of the interns, young interns, 20-something-year-old interns, who work in the library, in the actual, you know, place where they do the work. They have been invited, they told me, both of them, separately, up to the penthouse where he likes to have his feet massaged. I asked them if they went any further, like in Pulp Fiction. I don't know if you remember the beginning of Pulp Fiction.
Right. It's a very intimate thing, a foot massage.
Yeah, it's very intimate, exactly. And that's what they talked about at the beginning, remember? Anyway, they were very vague about if anything went further. I don't know if it goes further than feet massage, but I can tell you that when he has these parties on his terrace overlooking the Arkansas River, according to a guy who I interviewed who was there, sometimes he takes out a garden hose and sprays the women down in a kind of a wet T-shirt contest. So this is what Bill Clinton is up to.
It gets hot and muggy down there in Little Rock, Ed Klein. And you know what they say, what happens in Little Rock stays in Little Rock.
Stays in Little Rock.
Yeah. Certainly, thanks to the media ignoring it. Ed Klein, thanks for joining us. The new book, once again, Guilty as Sin, uncovering new evidence of corruption and how Hillary Clinton and the Democrats derailed the FBI investigation. Thanks, Ed.
Thanks, guys.
You got it.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
I'm Larry O'Connor alongside Brian Wilson.
Come on. She had a Clinton Foundation accepting contributions from foreign governments.
You are Donald Trump's apprentice. Let me talk about this.
Senator,
issue
I think I'm still on my time.
Well, I think, isn't this a discussion?
This is our open discussion.
Senator, let's talk about this.
Well,
let me interrupt you and finish my sentence.
Well, you get some sense of how it was going at times last night. A lot of interrupting going on there during the vice presidential debate. What did former Governor Jim Gilmore think about it? Well, interestingly enough, he's on the line right now to give us his assessment. Jim Gilmore, former Virginia governor and head of the Virginia Get Out the Vote effort for the Trump campaign. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Well, how did you feel it went last night?
Well, I was there. I was actually in the hall at the time of the debate. And I mean, it's pretty clear that Governor Pence won the debate. He was calm. He was much more relaxed in terms of the way that he addressed things. But, you know, mostly I think that, Senator Kaine lost the debate. I think that just simply shouting down his opponent, not just interrupting, but actually literally talking over and shouting down. Not only is it no way to do things, but it was trying to cover up the fact that, Kaine has no case for the United States. And so he had to shout his way through.
Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you the way
trying to show the example?
Yeah, no, but what I wanted to get to is, weren't you surprised by that? I mean, Kaine, it didn't seem like he was himself last night.
Well, again, I think that maybe we saw the real Senator Kaine last night, but none of that really matters. It's not all style points, after all. It's really the fact that what he was trying to cover up was the fact that on the economy, they have no case. They've been growing slow now for 8 years. They've put no action or plans in place to grow the economy any better. The economy's got to grow with about 3.5-4%. It doesn't. As a result of that, people are very insecure about their jobs. People are uncomfortable about their futures. And on the immigration issue, this is a thorny issue, to be sure. But Senator Kaine has no case. All he really just says is, look, we're just going to let everybody in the world in. There's going to be no enforcement of the law anywhere in the world. That's just no kind of approach. That's really what they're saying. And on national security, everybody in your listening area around Washington and Maryland and Virginia know how dangerous this really has become as a result of the Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama approach to foreign policy. They have no case. So as a result of that, frankly, he just had to shut Pence down, and everybody saw it, and everybody knows it.
Governor Gilmour, I'm already starting to pick up on the media spin here, because it's impossible to suggest anything other than what you've laid out, which is not only did Mike Pence win the debate on the issues, but Tim Kaine lost the debate on his bizarre behavior and mannerisms and style. But they're starting to say, but really it doesn't matter. It's just the vice presidential debate. In the long run, you know, this may be a one-day story, but it doesn't help. Well, yeah, listen, you're working on behalf of the Trump campaign in the Commonwealth of Virginia. What does the Trump campaign need to do after this debate, because this is a positive story for the Trump campaign, this is going to be a good news cycle here for at least a couple of hours, what do they need to do to show the voters what this means with regard to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump on the top of the ticket?
Well, they're not going to be able to shout down everybody the rest of the way. They're going to have to actually, the opposition, the Democrats are going to have to address the real mess that things are in as a result of the last 8 years. And the fact that Hillary Clinton is clear that she just wants to keep doing things the exact same way. So if you're insecure about your job, if you're unhappy about the fact your wages are not going up, if you're unhappy about that, you can't vote for Clinton Kaine. If you're just uncomfortable that we live in a society with no answer to the immigration issue, you can't vote for Clinton and Kaine. And if you're really concerned, as I am, and I've spent most of my life thinking about these foreign policy issues and working on them, as you know, as chairman of the National Commission on Terrorism, if you're concerned about these issues, you can't vote for Clinton and Kaine. So, what do we have to do? It seems to me that Trump and Pence simply have to get out there and really talk about what they believe are the right direction for the country. And I think people will respond to it favorably. There's already begun to be a shift in Virginia. Let's hope that continues on.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the next debates that are coming up and what Donald Trump might learn from watching the performance of his running mate.
Well, Pence was calm. After a while, he had to get in there and at least try to assert himself so that he could say something, because every time that he tried to answer, he had to fight both the commentator and he had to fight Senator Kaine. By the way, it's just ridiculous the way we handle these commentators. We just got to stop this. Two against one type of thing that's been going on. But never mind that.
Yeah, I'm with
you. The main thing is that the Trump just needs to get out there and show that he's presidential, that he can be the president. And I think that Pence has set the stage for him.
Can I ask you, a lot of people are trying to take a look at these two candidates here, Tim Kaine and Mike Pence, that is, and extrapolate what this means about a future Clinton or Trump administration. I mean, let's face it, these two guys represent the very first executive decision a future President Clinton or Trump would make. What does this tell you, Governor Gilmore, about the kind of cabinet they might assemble?
Well, I think it's exactly right. It's a very, very fine point. The very first decision that Hillary Clinton had to make, she picked the undistinguished senator from Virginia that, frankly, displayed himself in reality last night. But none of that mattered. What really matters is that if you're going to pick a cabinet that's going to actually begin to address the challenges that face the United States, we already see that Trump made the wiser decision first, right out of the gate, with a calm and experienced governor of the state of Indiana. And I think that it makes a big difference. But I think the main thing I've got to talk to you about is the challenges facing the people of the United States. If you think that it's time for a change, you can't vote for Clinton Kaine, because Kaine last night made it loud and clear. Not only are they going to keep on doing things the exact same way, slow economy, dangerous foreign policy, lawless society. If you want change away from that, you can't vote for Clinton and Kaine. That came very clear last night in the debate.
They're looking for 4 more years on steroids. Well said, Virginia Governor Jim Gilmore. Always good to have you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. The best of Mornings on the Mall.
I'm Brian Wilson, alongside Larry O'Connor.
And this November in Montgomery County, Maryland, not only will you be voting for president and for congressman and other state offices, you're also going to be voting on a ballot measure that would restrict the terms for Montgomery County supervisors. Joining us right now is one of those supervisors, one who has actually been elected to his fourth term that he is just in the midst of beginning. His name is George Leventhal, and he joins us now. Thanks for joining us, council member.
Good morning, guys.
So you and your colleagues are all opposed to this. In fact, you've all sort of dipped into your campaign chests and contributed, it seems, this week to the anti-term limit measure. What's the problem with it? Why? I mean, obviously, you support the term limits on the governor of Maryland, right, and on the president of the United States.
So Robin Ficker is a perennial loser. He has run for
now
under the sun.
Hold on. Now, why I didn't ask you.
There is no limit on the number of times he can lose.
Mr. Leventhal, I didn't ask you about Robin Ficker. I'm sorry. I mean, you know, we always have a good relationship here. I'm asking you about the basis of the proposition itself about term limits.
Well,
and you suddenly go into a personal attack against a politician in the state of Maryland. I don't understand that.
Right. You asked me the reason why other council members were opposed to this, and it is absolutely the case that if this measure passes, it will elevate the credibility of Robin Ficker. He is a nihilist. He wants to tear everything down.
Wow. So the reason you're against it is because you don't like Robin Ficker?
Well, that's a primary reason, I would say. Sure, yeah. If you know, you guys. Will
so
have
it's personal. It has nothing to do with the actual merit of the matter.
This is fascinating. Set Mr. Ficker aside, if possible, because thousands of Montgomery County residents all signed petitions to get this on the ballot. So Robin Ficker couldn't do it all by himself. So are you against all of those Montgomery County residents who also wanted to have this up for a vote?
So do me a favor and let me complete my sentence.
All
okay.
Right.
So there is no limit on the number of times Robin Ficker can lose, but he wants to limit the number of times that successful and popular elected officials can win. That's a logical disconnect. Voters have the ability to end the tenure of any elected official simply by defeating them in elections. And in Montgomery County, we have had competitive elections every 4 years for the offices of executive and county council, which are the offices which this measure would limit. We've had an executive defeated by a challenger. We've had multiple council members defeated by challengers. So voters have the power now in their hands to replace elected officials who they don't think are delivering. They can replace them with other people who run against them. I've had competitive elections every one of the 4 times that I've run. Now, I've been reelected because I'm responsive to my constituents and delivered government that works. But I've had colleagues who were not reelected. There have been incumbent council members in every cycle. We've always faced competitive elections, and in multiple situations, incumbent council members have been defeated. We've had an incumbent executive defeated.
Let me ask you this question, because it seems to me that you made a donation to this group that is fighting the term limits effort. That sort of speaks to me volumes that you're more focused on stopping the term limits than you are. I mean, if you were really in a competitive race, you wouldn't be spending money on that. You'd be spending it on your own campaign, wouldn't you?
What we've done in Montgomery County is we've passed a law that's going to provide public financing in 2018. It's a whole new set of rules, and it requires that the current campaign fund has to be spent down to zero, and then anyone who wants to compete in 2018 will start over from zero with a new fund that's limited. We won't be able, if we opt in, to take money from PACs or individuals or labor unions. Will only be able to take from individuals up to a limit of $150 per person, but we have to start from zero. So I had about $3,000, not a lot of money, in my campaign account. I gave half to the No on B campaign, and I gave the other half to the Montgomery County Democratic Party.
That campaign fund you had, I don't want to get bogged down in campaign finance rules. I'm just asking curiously. This isn't a challenge. The money you received in your campaign were from donors who wanted you to be elected to your office. How can you then take the money that they gave to you for the purpose of getting you elected and then redirect it to a completely different effort?
Maryland campaign law allows you to transfer campaign funds to other campaigns. It's been done, historically. It's perfectly legal, and it's fully disclosed.
So now if I can get back to the first question I asked, which is a fundamental aspect of term limits. Governor Hogan right now enjoys 71% popularity in the state of Maryland. He can run for one more term. But given your passionate opposition to term limits, you would be in favor of lifting Maryland's term limit on the state of governor, on the office of governor, wouldn't you? Shouldn't Larry Hogan be able to run for 16 years?
I'll say two things about that. Number one, I would happily vote for a third term for President Obama if I had the ability to do so. I don't especially think that the term limit on the executive is a great idea, but there is no proposal before us to lift it. But in addition, the power of the executive and the ability of the executive to command attention and accumulate influence and patronage is much greater than that in the legislature. So I do think it's a very different conversation whether the executive's term, the governor or the president, ought to be limited, or whether members of a legislature who are not as well known, and as I say, we've always had competitive elections in Montgomery County for county council, and multiple council members have been defeated by challengers.
So if a voter in Montgomery County believes in their minds that the ability, the patronage, the power, and the unresponsiveness of their Montgomery County Council members compels them to say, you know what, it would be a good thing to have these offices rotate out and we want some term limits. You wouldn't quarrel with that then, right? I mean, they seem to be using the same logic that you've used for the executive branch.
I try not to quarrel with anyone. I certainly try not to quarrel
except
with
Robin Ficker.
All right, so let me just ask you a question. I mean, isn't it true, though, in Montgomery County politics that if you get on the Apple ballot, and I know you've had your issues of late with the teachers, but, I mean, other candidates, if you get on that Apple ballot, you got 12,000 teachers going to vote for you, and then, that seems to be fait accompli. That pretty much drives the Montgomery County elections, doesn't it?
In 2014, which was my last race, I was not on the Apple ballot.
I mentioned that.
Of Montgomery County sent me back to the county council anyway.
Yeah, but isn't it true, though, that in most cases, if you get the support of the teachers, it's done?
No, that's not right. I mean, you could make the case that the teachers ascertain ahead of time who's likely to win, and then they endorse those likely winners, but I that's all speculation.
I'm just curious, Councilmember Leventhal, we're almost done, but yourself, Nancy Florine, Mark Elrich, and Hans Reimer, you're all the at-large members of the council, right?
Correct, and I would point out Nancy Florine also has never been endorsed on the Apple ballot and has been elected four times.
How many of you four at-large candidates are from the Tacoma Park area?
Yeah, that's an accurate observation. Three of the four live in the city of Tacoma Park, and if voters want to change that mix, they'll have the opportunity in 2018 when all of these offices are on the ballot. I will not be running again for the county council. I anticipate several of my colleagues, who have done our time, will not be running again. And we'll have campaign finance reform, so individuals can raise small contributions from individuals, and there will not be an incumbent advantage in terms of, you know, which has, I understand, occurred in the past in terms of large contributions from special interests. Those will not be on the table if candidates opt in to the clean money campaign finance reform option. So, you know, we're going to have a very competitive election in 2018 with lots of open seats.
Right.
And the fact that three of the four of us live in Tacoma Park is an anomaly, and I don't think it's going to be repeated.
Thanks for joining us, sir. I think that we've gotten a lot of information in this interview, and I'm sure that many people will note it and talk about it. It's always good to have
you. Great talking with you guys. Have a good day.
Same to you.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Now, more of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
I'm Brian Wilson alongside Larry O'Connor.
Yesterday, a D.C. council committee passed by a 3-2 vote a measure that would be the physician-assisted suicide law here in the nation's capital. They call it the Death with Dignity Act, and joining us right now is a spokesperson for an advocacy group on behalf of that bill. It's called Compassion and Choices, and his name is Sean Crowley. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Crowley.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, we have a little bit of data out of Oregon's experiment with this physician-assisted suicide policy, and I was struck by the top five reasons physicians are prescribing this life-ending prescription. It doesn't involve pain. It doesn't involve suffering. The reasons are things like, I feel like I'm a burden, or lost ability to move one's bowels, or loss of mobility. You can understand why people in the disability community hear that and get very concerned that there's some suggestion that that life, a life that requires some assistance, is in some way less equal or undignified, wouldn't you?
Well, what's interesting is, first of all, if you look at polling on medical aid and dying, people with disabilities support it at the same level as the general population. In fact, our political director has had MS for 15 years, and you cannot qualify for medical aid in dying unless you have an incurable terminal condition. So that's the bottom line. And the other thing I should note is the term physician-assisted suicide is really not the right term. And the reason it isn't is because there's a huge difference both legally and medically from somebody who is depressed, not terminally ill, and wants to take their life prematurely versus somebody who's already dying, wants to live, but simply does not want to suffer at the end of life. And suffering depends on the person. Some people don't want to live if they're going to have a quality of life that is terrible. And oftentimes, if you look at those stats that you cited, pain is also one of those things. And if you add up the numbers, it's over 100% because people cite multiple reasons for supporting wanting to have this option.
Just so I can have the appropriate terminology then, if physician-assisted suicide is not appropriate, what is appropriate?
Medical aid in dying is the more neutral term. Death with dignity, we understand that some people...
Medical aid in dying. So basically you're trying to remove the doctor out of the equation. Medical aid in dying is...
That's correct. And the reason we do is because there's a huge difference between medical aid in dying, which requires the person to self-administer the medication, by the way, which ensures that they won't be coerced or abused. And in fact, it's a Class A felony if that happens in the law, but it's never happened in Oregon to our knowledge. There have been a few investigations, but no prosecutions. So it's really the right term. It's the term you'll see in the literature now about it.
Well,
and
I don't want to get off in a sort of a tangent here, because I actually find a lot of what you say personally to me makes a lot of sense. Don't get me wrong, but when you start playing, you know, with the words that you use to describe it, I think you lose your credibility. It is a doctor involved in end of life decisions, and you could not do this without the assistance of a doctor.
Well, that's correct. I'm not going to argue with you on that point, but saying physician aid in dying, for example, even that small change implies the physician takes a more active role than they actually do, more akin to euthanasia, which is more of the European model, which we don't support, by the way, because that takes away the patient's control. And what's interesting, you mentioned the Oregon numbers. Obviously, you've read them, and you'll find that only about two-thirds of the people who get the medication actually take it. But they report getting great comfort, and so their families, in obtaining the medication, because that way they know that they won't have to suffer at the end, and some don't suffer, and they don't take the medication, which is another proof point that they're not suicidal by nature.
Are there some conditions that can be... let me rephrase it. You talk about suffering, and obviously when people hear the word suffering, they think of physical pain. Are you just talking about physical pain, though? Because for the most part, our incredible medical advances now have reached a point where there are very, very few physical conditions that one has that cannot be the pain, whatever pain is associated with, they cannot be alleviated with medications.
Well, it depends on the individual patient. And, for example, some people are morphine intolerant. And in a lot of ways, despite the doubling of hospice and palliative care over the last decade, we still don't really have a great handle on some pain. Some pain is intractable. Think of it this way. What was the premier pain relief drug in World War I? It was morphine, the same drug we use today. So it just goes to show you that...
Okay, so let me just ask you then. If this bill isolated, the reason for prescribing this would be incurable pain. You know, you say some people are morphine intolerant. Some people, you know, do not respond. Okay, so let's just address those some people. If everyone else who is feeling pain can be alleviated their suffering because of with morphine or with some sort of other medication, would that be appropriate? And then only those few people who don't respond to morphine, then they can take this drastic step.
Well, suffering, as I said, depends on the individual, and some people want to live life to the fullest, and when they can't live life even close to what they were like before, when they, you know, they can't function, they don't, their body doesn't function anymore, they think they should have the opportunity to exit gracefully from this earth. And I don't think we should be telling people, I don't think the government should be getting involved in these kinds of very private family decisions. And that's our position, and that's the position of most Americans if you look at the polling across the political spectrum.
What do you say to those who would argue, okay, well, now you have people playing the role of God and deciding when it's time?
Well, I think you could make the alternative argument that we're playing God in the medical world to some extent by prolonging the dying process, not extending life. Look, the point is, nobody has to participate in this law. It's an option for the terminally ill person. It's an option for doctors. It's an option for pharmacists. It's an option for hospice workers. And most people that are access medical aid in dying are in hospice. So it's not like everybody has to do this, and some people will never do it. We understand that. And the beauty of these laws is that it actually spurs earlier conversations about end-of-life care, increases the utilization of hospice and palliative care. And so that's a good thing. That's something that people who never utilize this option benefit from.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Sean Crowley, Compassion and Choices.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
If you do not believe in climate change, you do not believe in facts or in science or empirical truths, and therefore, in my humble opinion, should not be allowed to hold public office.
Or be allowed to be the king of the world. Leonardo DiCaprio last night at the White House.
Yeah.
President Obama hosting a bunch of techie types and Hollywood types. And Leonardo DiCaprio, you heard him there. If you don't believe in climate change, you're not qualified to hold elected office. You can't be the president. I wonder, it occurs to me, there may be some other thoughts, beliefs, ideas that should be a prerequisite for being the president. Do you have any other things out there that you think that a candidate for president should believe in, unless or else they're not qualified to be president?
If you do not believe in climate change, you do not believe in facts or in science or empirical truths, and therefore, in my humble opinion, should not be allowed to hold public office.
Isn't it interesting that when somebody says that they're offering up their humble opinion, it is very seldom humble?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? You know, there's a couple.
In my humble opinion.
It's not a humble opinion. It's a very self-centered and unhumble opinion.
Yeah, it's unclear whether he jumped onto his gas-guzzling, fuel-guzzling, carbon-emitting private jet after the speech, or if it was the private yacht parked in Georgetown spewed the carbon.
I've never understood why he's so adamant about this issue. Because, I mean, look, if you have global warming, there would be fewer icebergs. If there were fewer icebergs, his character would have survived, and there never would have been the crash of the Titanic. Okay, you're entitled to your opinion. But then to go to the step further and saying, if you disagree with me, then you just can't be an elected official. Well, who made you the king of the world?
In my humble opinion.
You've been listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Listen Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. to hear the show live on 105.9 FM WMAL.